The saying goes, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But what if you don't have access to fresh produce where you live? Or transportation to the doctor if that apple doesn't work? Or someone to watch your kids while you're at the doctor? Or, you get the point. A person's success in managing their health and wellness may depend much less on what happens inside of a doctor's office than what happens outside of it. There's plenty about where we are born, grow, live, and work, and how these circumstances are shaped by access to resources that influence the health we can achieve. There's a name for it: social determinants of health. So as a community, how might we begin to address these social determinants? How might we make progress towards reducing health disparities and improving health equity? How do we create a future where people receive support to stay well, rather than just treating them when they are sick? It starts with research. It starts with conversations. It starts with listening. It starts with understanding. Supporting people in their journey to good health is part of how we can create a better world. I'm Ellen Beckjord. Good Health, Better World is a show about how stronger communities begin with good health for everyone, even outside the doctor's office. In this first episode, we hear from Father Paul Abernathy, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Resilience Project in Pittsburgh, and Ray Prushnak, Associate Vice President, Program Development, and Executive Director of the UPMC Center for Social Impact. Let's go to Father Paul.
This is my little boy, Thomas. Say hi, bud. Hey, Thomas. Yeah. Can I ask you something? What'd you do today? Love you, bud. When I entered into ministry in this community, which is my community, there was just this litany of suffering, the most unimaginable tragic stories, not just one, but many of them, that happened over a period of time. And it became so very clear the impact that that pain was having on life in the community. And so we wanted to minister to this pain. We wanted to do what we could to help people in the community heal from this pain. We wanted to go from post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic growth, understanding that there's an incredible wisdom that can come from, you know, immense pain. And so that became really our work.
It's really my honor to welcome Father Paul Abernathy to this episode of the Good Health, Better World podcast. Father Paul, you are the CEO of the Neighborhood Resilience Project. You are an Iraq War veteran. You are a Orthodox Christian priest. And you are really, I think, an important figure who is doing so much in the Pittsburgh community. So again, we're so grateful that you've made time to talk with us today on Good Health, Better World. But I'll let you add anything you would like to your introduction.
It's so good to be with you. It's an incredible honor, and what an incredible conversation. So I'm very much looking forward to being with you today.
Well, let's start by talking about the Neighborhood Resilience Project, which was recently featured in the New York Times. Can you tell us a little bit about the Neighborhood Resilience Project?
The origins of the Neighborhood Resilience Project go back really 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, we, like so many other faith-based nonprofits, we started out really wanting to do something positive in our community. We're located in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I learned very quickly that really the greatest challenge that we were confronting was just the massive amounts of trauma that we as a community were facing. And it's not just, you know, the personal trauma, but this multi-generational complex trauma. The impact that it has on community has, especially the impact on health and well-being, has greatly undermined attempts to really develop our community. And it's not enough to create opportunity, but we have to get people so that they are healthy enough to sustain opportunity, because the impact that trauma has on health and well-being is quite severe. The Neighborhood Resilience Project has really emerged out of these conversations about how really do we develop our communities. And by that, we're talking about moving from a trauma-affected community to a resilient, healing, and healthy community. This is the crux of our work.
There's community development, but then trauma-informed community development, if I hear you correctly, is going about community development in a way that acknowledges, if you aren't simultaneously addressing trauma, that your efforts on community development are unlikely to reach their full potential. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. And you know, there's very well-meaning, well-intentioned development efforts that really focus solely, a lot of times in the United States, development really focuses on, you know, real estate and jobs. And yet at the same time, because of this trauma on health is so severe, if you create jobs or housing, unless we really work on that health and well-being, they're not going to be able to sustain that those housing and jobs. You know, for us, the goal of community development has got to be health and well-being, you know, not anything else.
Can you say a little bit more then about what the trauma-informed part of trauma-informed community development looks like?
What very seldom has, you know, been discussed is what really are the strategies to really bring people to life, to really foster that kind of participation, to really build a sense of community. And in fact, what really even is community? You know, trauma shatters relationships on the level of family. It shatters certainly relationships on the level of neighborhood and community. And so many of our communities, things are, you know, quite contentious, and understandably so, because of the amount of trauma that has occurred over multiple generations. There hasn't been that strong sense of community, these bonds that ultimately become the foundation for resilience. And so really, instead of having these community meetings where we have a small group of residents, the same group of residents that come time and time again, we really need to go into the heart of this community and really meet people where they're at and implement strategies that help raise people up, giving them voice and choice, giving people the information and access to develop and cultivate expertise in our community, being able to leverage that expertise, giving people access to real experts in different disciplines that can really help inform a pathway forward for our communities.
I guess one of the things I'm thinking about as you talk is, you know, how do we support healing in trauma-affected communities? But separately, how do outside entities build trust?
Yeah, this is such an important question. And of course, you know, trustworthiness, this is one of the trauma-informed principles. So this is a key aspect of healing, is working to build trust. And you know, the most important thing I think that I've learned about trust is that it's got to be demonstrated. You know, there's no way, you know, if we quite simply say, trust me, trust me, trust me, this certainly is not enough. I'm from this area, and I remember when I first came to the Hill District, you know, 10 years ago, you know, I was introducing myself, you know, I'm hoping to do something positive. I certainly don't want to get in the way of anything else happening in the community. And this woman said, okay, well, here's the thing. I have this niece, and she has 3 children, and they have no beds. So she needs 4 beds. And what I understood in that particular moment as I met her is that she was really trying to see if I was for real. These are moments. The community will give us moments to demonstrate trust. I understood that even if it wasn't within the quote-unquote scope of what I had hoped we would be doing, that this was, it was absolutely critical to get this, to get this this young woman and her three children beds. Certainly, it's an important thing. And then beyond that, it's a demonstration that, you know, you are heard. And yet, bringing those beds in, it was more than just about giving them a place to sleep. It was an acknowledgement that they, you know, they absolutely were heard. You know, there's a lot of things that we have to work through. We understand that education is a component of that. We understand that access to healthcare is a component of that. You know, there are food insecurity, all of these things. These are significant, you know, challenges. When you talk about education, there's a very vast conversation that happens there around that difference of opinions. And at the same time, we know statistically, we know as a result of scientific research, that if people have a door on their house that has two qualities, that if it's strong and aesthetically pleasing, that it has a significant positive impact on the well-being of that household. So the question becomes, is there an opportunity for something like that? It's a lot easier to give somebody a door that's strong and aesthetically pleasing than it is to overhaul the education system. You know, both have to be done, and yet at the same time, that door can lay the path to wider reform and opportunity. When we listen, we have got to be prepared to act. Whenever we have these listening sessions, is to make sure that whenever we go in there, we have the framework and, you know, really the resources to make something happen. Now, we know that we've got to be very measured. You know, we have limited resources like anyone else. Whenever we have the listening session, the preparatory work is to say, we've got to go into this, you know, and we won't go in saying we have all these resources that we're going to spend, but we've got to go into this knowing that we've got, that we're going to be prepared to, you know, to leverage resources.
Yeah, it seems like finding the place in the middle, because we also sometimes hear about when entities try to over-solution, you know, they don't listen and they jump right to, well, we know how to fix the problem for this community, which also typically doesn't end very well. But you also don't want to go in completely saying, well, we're here to listen and then we'll get started on figuring out how to implement what we've heard. You have to go somewhere closer to the middle where we've got resources, we're sort of ready to act on as much as we can quickly. Some stuff will be longer term and we need to listen and inform that plan over time. The other thing I'm thinking about as we talk is, and we use this phrase, social determinants of health. And as you're talking, it's making me sort of for the first time start to dislike that word determinant, you know, because it almost sounds like destiny, right? Like it can't be changed. This is a determinant of your health. But as you're saying, all of these things are within our reach to change.
That's absolutely right. You know, it's going to have to be people in these communities that are really the agents of change. And that's one of the things that's very important as we understand resilience, because, you know, in the history of the United States, there are some communities that have, you know, a lot stacked against them. And I'll never forget, there were some researchers that went to Homewood to give this presentation on the ACE study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, talking about the impact that trauma has on children, on adult health and behavior. You know, the more trauma we experience before the age of 18, the ACE study says, the more likely as adults, you know, it's going to have a negative impact on health and well-being. And I remember hearing the story, and at the end of the presentation, a woman from the community raises her hand and she said, "So you're saying we're all messed up." This can inadvertently be the wrong message. What building resilience is, and we have to understand this, is you know, it's not existing. It's thriving in the face of adversity. If we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, we have got also we have to at the same time talk about post-traumatic growth. If we really understand, yes, that the social determinants of health create extreme adversity on these communities. And then at the same time, there are many people who in these communities who, despite of this adversity, have really found a way to thrive and continue to be committed to building community. And we really work on that and building that, you know, developing that resilience. That can be a way to really, you know, leverage this resilience to help positively impact these social determinants of health.
I'd like to talk just for a moment about the COVID-19 pandemic, because on the one hand, it's easy to see how the pandemic has just made more apparent than ever the inequities that exist for communities of color in the context of health and health outcomes. On the other hand, I feel like those inequities are being recognized and action is motivated around them with a lot of new momentum too. And I'm just wondering if you could speak to the degree to which the pandemic is affecting the work that you do with the Neighborhood Resilience Project and how the communities that you serve are doing and what you think the way forward is looking like.
This is a really important question. When the pandemic began, one of the things, this is just, my personal perspective. Of course, I don't speak for the entire community. In the community, people, there were many people who were watching, the American response. People were like everyone else watching what was happening in New York City. And this idea that in New York City, one of the largest cities in the world, the city that has such influence over American culture and even, I would say, has an international impact, was struggling to have enough resources to really care for their sick. And when you are living in an under-resourced community and you're watching this great American city under-resourced, I think the fear then is that if the nation is under-resourced, will those resources ever make it to these communities that are already under-resourced? That there's going to be this, if there's a limited number of resources and there has to be this choices that are made in resource allocation, will these communities be left behind? And that was a very real fear. And from that fear and concern, developed this commitment to go through our community and really do what we could to implement an epidemiological framework to combat the spread of this disease. This gave birth to, what's now known as the community health deputies. And the thing about this is, I think, a perfect example where you start to say, well, we don't have a lot of money, but we do have people. We don't have necessarily the resources of the great universities, but we have our grandmothers and our uncles and our aunts and our brothers and sisters who remain, tirelessly committed to loving their community. And so that's what we leveraged. We also knew that we are not the first humans to go through this kind of a pandemic or epidemic. So we used what knowledge we had based off of especially our experience with gun violence. Taking an epidemiological approach to gun violence as a disease, we're able then to adapt that to COVID-19 and train community members in an epidemiological framework to combat the spread of COVID-19, to support basic needs in the community, especially food and medicine, and also to support community mental health. It ended up being extraordinarily effective initiative. These were all volunteers. We had trained 108 over 13 different communities that were out there doing this as volunteers. It's an indicator of what the resilience we need to leverage within our own communities is and how this can then set the stage forward. So as we look really now forward, having this experience, as part of our community's narrative, in this pandemic and, in the context of wider civil unrest as a result of racial inequity, we understand that there is now an opportunity to really shift the narrative and to have some real structural change. We need to understand that social initiative is extremely important. And that this social initiative has got to be leveraged. It's got to be incorporated into our perspectives on community development, on public safety, on public health. This social initiative where we have people that have been far too often excluded from, building their own communities. This is an opportunity for them to do this. And the final thing I'll say is this. In the civil rights movement, it didn't happen, as a matter of chance. There was an extraordinary network of training centers. We had the nonviolent training centers. We had the citizenship schools, the freedom schools.
The last question I wanted to ask you, you are a leader of a faith-based organization. And when we think about trauma-affected communities, I can't help but think about how one way of talking about that is as a series of failures, ways that these communities have been failed over and over again for centuries by structures in society, by people. And it seems it's such brave and sacred and courageous work to build resilience in these trauma-affected communities. But it also seems like there's also an ask around forgiveness. And I'm just wondering how you think about forgiveness in the context of the work that you do.
Oh, this is such a beautiful question. You know, forgiveness has got to be a cornerstone of this work. In the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, you know, the Birmingham office of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference during the Civil Rights Movement, they had a commitment card they asked demonstrators to sign, and in that commitment card, one of the tenets that they made a commitment to was to seek justice and reconciliation, not victory. With this, we must understand that their understanding, which is also ours, is that you cannot have justice without reconciliation. So there has to be, however, an unwavering commitment to forgive. And if we are going to have an unwavering commitment to forgive, we also are going to hope that there is an unwavering commitment to confess from those who have done these types of things. And I will tell you, it's not enough to say, well, I haven't personally done anything. You know, we're all living in a system in which we've either benefited or we haven't benefited from, you know, the history that we have inherited. We've got to learn to take responsibility for that history and confess it.
Yes, it seems to me that that much like I think trust is something that needs to be earned, you know, forgiveness needs to be earned. It's not just granted. It has to be earned. Is there anything else you would like to share with the folks listening about the Neighborhood Resilience Project, about the work that you're doing, your own thoughts about social determinants of health or health equity? Anything you'd like to say, Father Paul?
The only thought that I have is that a new and better reality is possible. And it's only going to be possible if we do this work together. We mustn't be so determined to build an organization or institution as we are to build a movement in which we can all come together in the spirit of hope and reconciliation and face the darkest aspects of our society head on, with the understanding that to do so will bring about assured victory. We can overcome these determinants, these social determinants of health that are negative. We can overcome this. And with the understanding that the health and well-being of every last man, woman, and child in our community must be our objective. You know, with this understanding, we can build a better future.
Thank you so much, Father Paul Abernathy, for spending time with us today. I just can't tell you what a privilege it's been to get to listen to you talk about these incredibly important issues. I'm so grateful that you're here in Pittsburgh, that you're a part of our community.
It's such a joy to be with you as well. So thank you so much for having me.
Okay, I'm so pleased to be here today with my colleague, Ray Prushnak, on the Good Health, Better World podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thanks for having me, Ellen. I'm Associate Vice President for Program Development and Executive Director of our UPMC Center for Social Impact.
Really looking forward to having this time with you to talk about social determinants of health. Sometimes we call them social influencers of health. I know we had a conversation recently where we talked about systemic influencers of health, but whatever they're called, I'd love to hear your thoughts about why those topics are so important, especially right now.
We think about, you know, the whole person approach to healthcare. You know, there's been increasing understanding about how the physical environment can influence people's health. But I think in particular, to sort of step back a little ways, we've been hearing the term social determinants of health as a buzzword for many years. The importance has really emerged since the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, one of the things that I like to point to is that with the Affordable Care Act, we saw a lot of important progress. It really comes down to a lot of small changes that improved quality and moved towards value, not volume. We saw major reductions in readmissions, unplanned care for those types of pieces of care. We saw vast improvements, but those improvements weren't equitable. Those improvements relied on traditional health plan tools. They relied on, you know, things like telephonic outreach and in-home visits. And what we have realized is that still there are communities that are falling behind and individuals who are falling behind. There have been some incredible analyses done by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Kaiser Family Foundation, and others that have shown that the vast majority of health outcomes are driven by social, environmental, and behavioral factors, not the things that happen in a clinical setting.
And if we could stay there for a minute, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how that has affected UPMC's commitment, because we know it's so critical for improving health and health outcomes, especially for traditionally underserved communities.
Absolutely. And, you know, a key part of UPMC's vision statement as a part of its mission is delivering care to the right people in the right place at the right time. And it is impossible for individuals who are facing many issues like economic hardship. It's very difficult for them to focus in on their health and do the things that we're asking them to do as an integrated delivery system, whether it's, you know, coming to an appointment or closing a gap in care by, you know, going and getting that screening. So it is very important as we think about, you know, how do we get to the next level in healthcare through all the improvements that have occurred in recent decades. The next frontier is linking these social factors to how healthcare organizations operate.
There's a long history at UPMC beyond, you know, before the Center for Social Impact was established, of making commitments to try to improve social context for the communities that we serve.
Going back more than a decade, for instance, we have been working with a community organization, Community Human Services, to support our members who are experiencing homelessness. This has proven as a very effective program. And similarly, our, you know, organization has spent a great deal of time focusing on hiring individuals who are in the TANF program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Our history also extends in other ways in terms of the benefits that we offer. So we have a history in offering things like support for over-the-counter, you know, drugs that wouldn't be covered by your health plan, or things like transportation and post-acute meals if you're recovering from a hospitalization. Sometimes, you know, the last thing you really are prepared to do or are able to do is to be able to get up and cook a healthy, nutritious meal. So with the formation of the Center for Social Impact, you know, what we're trying to do is align all of these different areas. We also are looking at how our benefits and clinical programs that are oftentimes helping people navigate these systems can work together. So our department is poised to be a forum to bring those groups together and align in a greater strategy to address social determinants of health. Another major part of what we do, and I think what we, you know, see as our North Star, is thinking through what social interventions are working for who and when. And we are partnered with our Center for High Value Healthcare, and our department sits within that structure as well to make sure that we're evaluating and able to disseminate what we find. You know, it's really important as we sort of enter into this new frontier that we share and that we all learn, because all healthcare organizations are going to be going through this transformation. The conversation has, you know, really shifted in the time since we started. So the question of equity in health insurance is interesting. So as a healthcare organization and as a health insurer more specifically, our health plans are designed in an equal way, but not an equitable way. We don't set copays based on the necessity or the, you know, difficulty you might experience. So, and there are many reasons for that, but these structures, while they limit what healthcare organizations are able to do, it doesn't speak for the things that we can do. And those are areas where it's about how do we view our network, how do we allocate our resources, and, you know, how do we communicate with our members in a culturally competent and, you know, making sure we're understanding, you know, where those health disparities exist. But beyond that, this question around how do we meet some of those economic needs that are presenting barriers is really the crux of where, you know, this conversation takes us. Oftentimes we focus energy and resources around people that are using a lot of services. So someone who's in and out of the emergency room, someone who is using a lot of unplanned care or maybe isn't, you know, following up on needed appointments that are, you know, resulting in, you know, more costly services later. And, you know, oftentimes what we're ignoring are some of the other disparities and gaps that exist where we have members who aren't connecting to the healthcare system. And what we know about a member is often, you know, what comes on a claim.
Right. Right. Which is often far too late. And so our visibility being anchored on utilization of care. Right? But I think you're talking about the necessity to see, find, and offer service to folks who aren't using care, because sometimes that represents as big, if not a bigger, set of problems or risk for those people. How do we address social needs? How do we coordinate and expand access to benefits? And how do we support underserved communities? Can we talk about each of those in turn? Because I think within each of those, there is like some specific areas of focus or things that the Center for Social Impact is really going deep on.
You know, to first talk about, you know, addressing social needs, an important point that that emerges in this discussion around social determinants is the difference between a social determinant of health and an individual's social need. So when we talk about social determinants of health, we are talking about at a greater policy level and a system level where, you know, you may have a public transportation system that's, you know, failing your specific community. There may be public policies that range from, you know, tax policy to, you know, how school districts are funded that impact your life in very real ways. Those areas really are at that higher determinant level. Where we spend a lot of our energy and time is around social needs. So how do we help our member who may be needing a ride to get, you know, from their home just this once, or maybe they have a longer term need to, you know, have transportation to and from their regular appointments? That's an important distinction. And, you know, I think health plans have more comfortably, and we ourselves have more comfortably been in that space addressing those individual social needs. On the determinant level, we're also exploring ways how we can do that in a broader way in the months to come. We can't go it alone, and there are oftentimes many other supports in our members' lives. Being able to work with those systems is incredibly important. But those systems aren't always set up to work together. Many of our members who are unable to be reached, oftentimes their needs are being supported by a care manager that works for a local human services agency, or they're connected in some other way that's not visible to us. So connecting people to benefits is part of the story, but connecting to the benefits that they're already aligned with really gives us a whole person view. And aligning with community partners is essential to our success.
Part of what I'm thinking about as I hear you talk about this is saying these community partnerships are essential. We certainly have a role to play and services that we can provide, but we're not looking to be in the lead by default. We want to be part of a network of partnerships with other organizations that have the same goal we do of caring for underserved populations. And I wonder if you could talk about challenges that maybe we face as we seek to deepen these partnerships with community organizations from the vantage point that we sit in at UPMC, and whether you think humility has played an important role in making progress on establishing those partnerships, or just how you think about humility as a value in the context of doing this work.
Yeah, so I see humility as a core value for myself and a core value for how we approach our work generally. And we know so little about which social interventions work for who and when. We need to rely on community partners who have decades of expertise in addressing these needs. So as we think about our role and our connection with those organizations, it's also incredibly important for us to join them at their table and not to expect them to come to ours. So we have to, you know, make ourselves available and aware and be ready to listen. And also understanding that where we bring certain strengths, the strengths of many community organizations are, you know, linked to how close they are to our members, our communities, and the people we serve. They have on-the-ground context, and they know their neighborhood best. Community-based organizations also approach the world differently. You know, they're looking to address a specific issue or support a specific community, but they're looking at the community at large as a, you know, health plan, you know, for many reasons, we're going to be focused in on our own members. We don't have a formal relationship with someone who's not our member. We are also going to be thinking about, you know, return on investment differently than a community organization. And when I say return on investment, that's not limited to dollars and cents. Does it, you know, add measurable value to the community? Does it help us in other ways in terms of engaging our members so they take more control of their health? Is it, you know, measurable in, you know, a quality context? Can we, you know, see that our member is, you know, succeeding in other ways? And does it ultimately result in, you know, our members being more satisfied? Also working with community-based organizations, you know, you need to understand that they have very different capacity than we do.
I just want to sort of make a note of the fact that a lot of the work that you and the Center for Social Impact are doing is that work. And that's such important work because you and the team are being really mindful of how to work with a lot of intention in our efforts to address social determinants of health. And we have a history of doing that, and we've been doing that. But moving into a new level of doing that work really in the context of the communities that we serve with community partners and doing the hard work of figuring out how to do that well. You know, one of the things that I think about is the degree to which, especially now in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, the need to make progress on solving for the inequities that we know exist in health and healthcare has never felt more present or more urgent. You know, it feels like an emergency because it is. But at the same time, this is work that requires patience and persistence and humility and to take the long view. So how do you balance knowing that this really is a long game against some of the urgency that we know exists around solving for these really challenging problems?
The urgency that, you know, COVID has created and the spotlight that is put on, you know, some of the gaps in our safety net, you know, couldn't make this topic more real. And I think in many ways it is an opportunity where, you know, I think our organization with years of preparation and work in this space was poised to not just build out new ideas, but to build on the existing work that was occurring. And so it's opportune times like this where we can reflect and look at our strengths, look at our partnerships, and find unique ways to meet member needs, whether it is, you know, formalizing connections with organizations like United Way and 2-1-1 and making sure that we're connecting our members when a need emerges, or in the way that our community paramedicine team is able to deliver a food box if somebody is in an emergent situation. Even in environments where health plans are doing well, you still need to make mindful decisions around, is this the best use of resources? And so as we look at our opportunities in this space, you know, how do we begin to evaluate which social interventions are working? And that's a strength that health plans can bring to this environment. And it's also important to look at how this fits into the overall fabric, because it's not going to be health plans or, you know, healthcare organizations that solve for these problems. It has to be a community-wide effort. It has to be, you know, where we may be a convener, we may be an important voice at the table, but it's not necessarily our table, and we're certainly not the only voice. Now, I think what we're bringing to the conversation, and where UPMC Health Plan has been a leader, has been in developing practical approaches to this problem. It can be very easy to get lost in how can we as one singular organization solve for, you know, hunger in this country, or how can we as one organization, you know, solve for the transportation gaps we face in our community or our education system or otherwise. I think we've approached this with a great deal of humility and looking for community partners that are willing to experiment with us. So how do we find our mutual strengths and, to the extent possible, braid together resources that otherwise won't be, you know, working together as naturally? And it's not going to be a health insurance organization. So from a practicality standpoint, identifying areas where you can make a difference, where we know we all can make a difference, is in collaboration.
And so we're certainly not alone as a payer in wanting to commit time and resources to this space of social determinants of health. But what I hear you saying is the way that the UPMC Health Plans Center for Social Impact has chosen to take a big step forward into this space is through this partnership model, not alone, but in partnership with the other community organizations that bring an incredible amount of resource, expertise, and value to the table, and thinking really carefully about how we can, as you say, braid those resources together. What we bring something to the table, to be sure, but it's only one slice of what needs to come together to really affect change for these entrenched problems.
Absolutely. And that all begins with aligning goals and, you know, understanding where your partner is trying to go and where you're trying to go as an organization. So beginning with that humility that we don't understand, using our evaluative resources and our data-driven mindset to prove out some of these points, and then be able to expand them. As we look at these interventions, it also can't be where a health plan swoops in and funds a program and goes away. It really truly has to be longer-term partnerships. So understanding how to do that, and understanding, you know, how to do that across 67 counties in Pennsylvania, and understanding how to do that in a meaningful way where you require that individual relationship, is a challenge, and is a challenge that we're all going to continue to work through.
Ray, I want to thank you so much for taking time to spend with us today on the Good Health, Better World podcast so that we could learn more about what the UPMC Center for Social Impact is doing and hear your great thoughts on social determinants of health. It's really been a pleasure to spend this time with you today.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Good Health, Better World, presented by UPMC Health Plan. Have a joyous holiday season. Be sure to come back next time